we're actually going to be real soon. You can erase a lot of this. But I wanted to let you know that, what's your name?
Dennis.
Dennis is recording this because he's a docent at Albright Knox.
We'll upload it and then it's available to the world.
You might want to wait until I've done more than one of these. I have to preface this. I've been teaching for like 30 some odd years, but this is the very first docent tour I've ever done in my life.
At the end of it, we can make a strategic decision. Hello.
Don, you did your homework.
How are you? Welcome.
And actually, I knew I'll bounce off of some of what we were talking about the other night. It would be good, you know?
Yes, good.
But my name is Don Kimes. I'm the Artistic Director in the Visual Arts here at Chautauqua. And this is an exhibition that I have curated this year. And to give you a little bit of background into how the exhibition started and the whole idea behind it, I'll begin with that. Mostly, I want to hear, try to respond to thoughts or questions that you might have about the work in this particular exhibition. I'm not an art historian, I'm a painter, and but I'm very interested in this generation of painting. It's kind of my teachers were very, Hoffman over here was a teacher of several of my teachers. I knew Lee Krasner fairly well, and Franz Klein was the best friend of one of my sculpture teachers. So I'm really interested in that generation in New York, that's part of the reason that I'm beginning with this. Another part of the reason that we're doing this exhibition is that, first of all, let me back up. Louis Grachos, who was the director at Albright Knox, is on the advisory council to the artistic director of the visual arts here, which is me. So he's one of the members of the council. And he and Leslie Zemsky, who's a Chautauquan and also at on the board, board chair at Albright Knox, we're talking about how, here we have these two great Western New York institutions kind of operating separately from one another. Great cultural institutions. I mean, people come from all over the world to go to both of these places, and yet we're not, why aren't we making some sort of connection? Every summer I go up there. Look, I think the Albright Knox Art Gallery is one of the jewels in terms of, I look at Albright Knox, the Phillips Collection, the Barnes Collection, and the Pushkin Museum. It's like probably my four favorite museums in the world. And it has to do with scale, it has to do with the quality of the collection, and it may have to do with personal taste. But there's something about the intimacy of all of those four museums that has always brought me back to them. Of course, I live in Washington, D.C., and I live in the museums all the time, these great museums, the National Gallery of Art, for sure. But those four museums have something very human about them. Mm-hmm. And a kind of weirdly connected history as well, or connected in terms of what they represented in their regions. So I've always loved Albright Knox. So Leslie and Lewis and I had lunch one day, and we talked about why are we not making this connection? We've both been around since the early latter 19th century, and what could we do? One of the things I love doing in Washington is I have my graduate students have them go online and look up what's not being shown at the National Gallery of Art, and give me a list, and I call them up, and we go down, and I ask them to pull the work out for us, and then they have to talk about the work. And it's a great, it's like one of the high points of their experience as graduate students, to be able to go down there and have somebody pulling up 20 Richard Diebenkorns that nobody's seen before. Or that not many people have seen, that aren't out or whatever artist it might be. So I thought, Albright Knox has a fairly extensive works on paper collection, and Lewis said, we don't get to put that work out, so as much as we would like to. So that was the seed for the whole idea, was let's do an exhibition about that pulls on that resource, that gets Albright Knox out there, that makes a connection between the two institutions, and that lets people see things that they generally would not be able to see. That evolved to an idea about abstraction, because we have this gallery. Quite honestly, the gallery has done very well. You know, our gallery, we sell a lot of work, huge amount of work. But one of the things that we noticed is that we don't sell much abstract work. And that it generally has to have a kind of something identifiable to grab a hold of. And mostly that has to do with not really understanding a lot about abstraction. And I thought, this is, I've been at Chautauqua now 26 years. I've been very involved in the whole educational side of Chautauqua. We could turn this towards something that would help inform people about abstraction. It's not something particularly unique to Chautauqua either. This is true around, across the country. It's a kind of an odd irony that, as I note in the catalog essay, these are downstairs if you want to get a catalog for the show too, the five volumes, the two greatest contributions of America, or at least two of the greatest contributions of the United States in the 20th century to world culture, not just to American culture, but to world culture, that come out of America are jazz and abstract expressionism. They are the two 20th century indigenous art forms that went around the world. Now, they've got sources, you've got the blues and you've got the delta and you've got places where jazz comes from, but it is the first time that that music begins in this country and reaches a kind of I won't call it a zenith, because jazz is still evolving, as is abstraction. But it reaches a point, where it, as Natalie says in the essay, was like a shot heard around the world that penetrated deep into the Soviet Union in the middle of the Cold War without the internet yet. And the same thing is true of abstract expressionism. They were the two big cultural contributions of the United States in the 20th century to world culture. While jazz is understood, generally people appreciate jazz in this country. The fact is, there's a lot less. There are still people still have the same arguments about abstraction that they did in 1955 when Jackson Pollock first showed up on the cover of Life magazine. That's what is 1955? It's 56. 56 years ago. So I want to, part of what I'm trying to do with the exhibition is put some work out there, talk about it, try to elevate the level of understanding, at least in this community, about what abstraction is and about how important that contribution was to world culture. A little footnote is this became such an interesting idea that we applied for a grant from the Oshai Foundation in Buffalo, and we're doing actually three exhibitions over the next 3 years. We're doing the beginnings of American abstraction that you see in this room, and then we'll do a later period, post-1960s, and then the third show will be contemporary abstract. And by that point, everybody's going to understand it. Sure.
That's the source, the impetus for the exhibition. I don't know, does anybody, you guys feel free to jump in and ask a question.
Just a comment that I think is wonderful, your comparison of jazz to abstract expressionism. Both received the same reception, of course. They both
right.
were rejected.
Absolutely.
They both were seen as
absolutely.
As aberrant and what have you.
And
That's an interesting, we had a really nice conversation the other night, but we could keep going. But it's an interesting thing about original art forms, that they almost, Lois, I can't hear. The interesting thing about original art forms is it's not just jazz, it's Beethoven, you know, who we love. It's Cézanne, who we all, everybody in this room thinks Cézanne is a great artist, probably. Yeah, beautiful, love, no problem understanding Cézanne. Everybody hated Cézanne while he was alive. They said he was one of the most important critics of the 19th century Paris, late 19th century Paris, not that long ago, 1870s, 1880s, said that this work is the work of a drunken privy cleaner, and he wrote that, and Rembrandt, late Rembrandt, that, The Night Watch, his career was destroyed for his greatest painting. His career ended with The Night Watch, which we all today know is probably the greatest Rembrandt out there. So what I'm saying is, on the one hand I say, these guys, some of them were born in the 19th century and people still don't understand their work. That's not really that long a period of time. We've had 400 years I might have a little less than 400 years to understand Beethoven. The point is, when work is original, which this is the first time, I hear the comment over and over, I could have done that, but then you didn't. This is the first time this was ever done. And the other thing I have to say about this, to contextualize it a little bit, but not overly contextualize it, you have to think about what the world was like in the 1940s. Look at what was going on. I mean, it was falling apart. It was, everything was out of control. That's not really the motivating force of this work, but I think artists are kind of like vessels. You just pour stuff into them and something comes out, whether they know it or not. And I think that some of that wildness, some of that chaos, could also have to do with the fact that they're in this place and this world is doing what it's doing. Another thing that I think makes this work even though several of them are Europeans transplanted to the United States, it was the first time this work was done, and these were many of the Americans. It's a significant number of the people who were the Americans are in this show. And they were working in New York in the 1940s, some in the 30s, but this whole, much of this group, not all of it, because Mandelman was in, which is interesting, she was in the Southwest, and you get a whole different take there. They're in this place that doesn't have this long history. What America has, one of the really interesting things to me, because Lois and I spend a lot of time going back and forth to Italy, and the way I think you really understand your own culture is to live in another culture. You don't understand, you cannot understand your own culture if you only live in your own culture. You have to live somewhere else. And it wasn't until we lived in Italy for a year that I realized how American I actually am. But one of the things that is, it's important to understand in terms of American, the American heritage, is space. And like all these guys talked about was space. It's all about space and what kind of space, a flat space, horizontal space, and infinite space, a space that has the tautness of a surface of a drum. Those are the kind of things that many of these artists talked about. The space of America, what we have here are small ones, and I need to get to an explanation of that in a second too. But the space of America relative to European space is horizontal and vast, where European space is vertical and vast, you know, that way. Vertical historically, you know, you look at a wall in some town in Perugia and you realize people have been walking through that opening in that wall for 3,000 years, you know. That's not something to think about. We have here. But what you do have is this kind of wall-like expanse of space. And I think that enters into the work. If you look at, like, Lee Krasner's work on that back wall, to try and understand something about it, you need to understand something about American space, the rawness of America, the youth of America, and then come to that work. It is reflected in the nature of the way she approaches the space in that work. It has a lot to do with all of that kind of a sensibility. Those three prints back there would not have been made in Europe, could not have been made in Europe. And much of the work that you see here, I would say similar things about. What else should I talk about? So what we have, like I'm starting here, this is Avery, 1943. Really a precursor, to a lot of the rest of the exhibition. But it's 1943, 60 some years ago, and 68 years ago, and working with the landscape but abstracting from it. One of the interesting things that I mentioned, we were talking to Peter Agostini, who I said was a best friend of Franz Kline. One of Franz Kline's best friends. And Peter said that about this whole idea of abstraction, first of all, he said, you know, because Peter was in the WPA, part of the thing that made it possible for these artists to exist was the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, because they were able, even if they weren't in the genius division where you were allowed to do whatever you wanted to do, where you were paid instead of painting a specifically described mural on a wall in a post office. It's a very important thing. It gave artists for the first time the opportunity to work as artists in this country without necessarily having to have a second and a third career in order to go home and paint in the middle of the night. And I was talking to Peter about abstraction and risk and all that kind of stuff. What do you think made all of this movement happened. How did it generate itself? And he said, one of the things he said that was important was, it was funny, he said, well, it wasn't really risk. Nobody was looking. Because it was all, the Europeans had all come over, you had Mata, and you had David here, you had all these people who had come from Europe, and they had kind of taken over the galleries and the museums and all that sort of thing. And so really, when Pollock and de Kooning and Lee Krasner and Franz Kline and Hans Hofmann, when all these people were painting and making their great work, the artists, nobody knew them, you know? They had no galleries, they had no museum shows, they had no critical. So Peter said, it wasn't like we were risking anything. There wasn't anything to lose. It's kind of like freedom is just another word, you know? But of course, things changed and over time. And there was this division, very strong division. And an interesting aspect of it, with so much of it happened around 8th Street in New York, in that little small area between 8th Street and 14th. There's like a little triangle between 8th Street and 14th Street. Everything happened in that little triangle. The artists lived there, the Waldorf cafeteria was there, that's where they went to get 5-cent cups of coffee and talk about life and death and the relationship of this line to the edge of that rectangle and talk very passionately about it. But I like that. And the other thing he said, I said, what about abstract, what about abstraction? And one of the ongoing, continuing over a long period of time, debates was abstraction. Is it abstraction or is it non-objective pain? So he said, you know, abstraction means you abstract. It means to take from. You take from something. And that kind of ties into this whole idea about the history, the rawness, the wilderness, the wildness of America. It's like coming from your experience of the world, a lot of the work. Starting over here with Milton Avery, early before everyone else, and the show kind of gradually becomes a little, not completely, because we were hanging according to what looked good together, too. But it tends to be older to newer going around the room this way. And I don't know how long I should probably not talk too much.
That's probably good. Okay. I mean, does anybody have any questions? That's a great history thing.
Okay, all right. So, is there anything I should throw in, Lo? You can think of? Okay. So, anyway, the next. Yeah.
If I'll make another comment.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, the abstraction of the Avery, obviously, you see the images that he abstracted from.
Right,
that's
right.
The remnants of those images.
Right.
It's called Galway, Letter Hoffman, and there's no way that you can imagine what that's abstracted from or what was in his mind.
One of the, because I could do long lectures on every artist in this room, and we'd be here forever, but that is like as essential as Hoffman ever gets. It's actually a poster. But if you know a little bit about Hoffman, a lot of what he talks about is the language of painting, and he tries for the first time in history to really define what the language of painting is in a series of essays called The Search for the Real in the Visual Arts. And he talks about what one color means in relation to another, and how one color pushes while another pulls, and how drawing relates to color, and he talks about metaphor, and he talks about tension. Things that are alive have tension. Things that are dead have no tension.
Look how far that those words are and those concepts are from representational art.
And that all comes from representational art. He taught his whole life and had a model the whole time. The reason I say that's as essential as Hoffman gets is he's like taking it all the way down to like saying this is all it is. You know,
paint
a couple of colors. You know, you put these three colors together. Now, you find, the thing interesting about The Search for the Real in the Visual Arts is you read that, and you can look at Rubens and see that Rubens was teaching that. You know, I mean, the other thing about the show, quickly, is that I wanted to do a show that, because we've seen a lot of their signature work, I wanted to do a show that showed a little bit about the thought processes. And that's a really good painting to pick out that way. Because it's like, this is, we have students here, a lot of very good students, and I wanted to do a show that, and people are trying to understand more about art. And I didn't want to do a show that was just kind of the signature work. I wanted to, most of what you do is like in your studio, nobody's looking at it on paper or something, you know, it's just off on the side. And a lot of, these are more like the thinking pieces for a lot of artists. A lot of what you see in here is more about the thought process than, like, I think Klein's a great example of that. Because if you know Klein, you see Klein in there, but you see a lot of other people in there too. You see de Chirico, you see some of the surrealists, but you see Klein too. And it's like him wrestling with his idea.
Dan, the article in the Chautauqua Daily, I thought made good points about familiarity.
Right, right.
We're not familiar with abstract.
That's
art,
right, that's right.
As opposed to hearing music
right.
almost
that
all the time.
Yeah, that
I thought that was a wonderful insight, and I was going to almost ask the group, how many people came into this 2 o'clock lecture liking ahead of time abstract art or confused by it and wanting to know more? Because
right.
it is a language in its own right. And without any explanation, you don't know what you're looking at.
Right. You have to. It's just like the whole, that's why I make the point about Beethoven. You know, the reason we can understand this artist whose work was rejected at a certain point in time, because it was just loud and banging. You know. You said that. The reason we understand is we've had the time to develop or to catch up in a lot of ways. Now these are more like sonnets than epic stories. But the reason that familiarity, and I kind of left that point. When you're making things as opposed to representing something that was done a long time ago, you're going to have people who, most people are not going to understand it, but that's nothing unusual. It's always been that way. And that's kind of where we are with this. I could put drawings of, Delacroix in here, and we'd have a lot more understanding. Though the reaction 100 years ago to the Delacroix might have been exactly the same way people react to Jackson Pollock today.
Could you give a little explanation of the ink squiggles?
That's Philip Guston, who was also, he was one of my teachers, and was that Guston, he was a young, slightly younger than a lot of the first generation abstract expressionists. And this is sort of on the way to finding his own voice. But he did do a lot of studies where he developed characters. And this is him, and also was very interested in automatic procedures, in sort of the subconscious. Very interested in the subconscious. And then Guston has a period of work which is very connected to the earlier, slightly, I mean, I'm talking 5 years earlier, but they were the Kooning, Pollock, were the Klein, they were the groundbreakers, and Guston was a little bit younger. And so he's kind of caught in this space between that totally abstract thing and when he goes to his later work, which really uses a lot of characters and actually has a lot of specific images in it, but they're painted in a very clunky way. He had developed a big reputation as an abstract painter at this time. Well, this is actually a little bit later, but it's still kind of that subconscious thinking. The other thing you look at, everything in a painting either relates, this is the whole secret of painting. It's either horizontal or vertical. And everything else is what happens between the horizontal and the vertical. Here's the landscape and here's the vertical. It could be thinking about rain.
It could be.
It could be thinking of, he could be sitting in the studio, it could be a rainy day. I don't know. I wasn't there for the, 7 minutes that he was working on this, but he didn't tie it in. This is early. This is right in that transitional period between where he's kind of an abstract artist. He really goes and becomes a more kind of these big, clunky figures that he did later in life. And he became famous for the earlier work. The great thing about Philip was that he became famous for this earlier work, and he still took a chance and said, and he changed, and his career was again destroyed. And it's only now that he's like being recognized again. He was successful, his work was in all the museums. He spent the last 15 years of his life teaching because he couldn't afford to do anything else. All right, thanks. I got to let you go on to the rest of the... Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.